Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how one university professor is teaching children about community, civics, empathy, and giving. And first, are Google and Facebook increasing economic inequality, harming the arts, and damaging democracy? Our next guest says yes.
Jonathan Taplin was the founding director of the USC Annenberg Innovation Lab. He is an Oscar-nominated filmmaker, a music manager, and author. His latest book is called Move Fast and Break Things: How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Have Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Jonathan Taplin. It is great to have you here with us.
Good to be here.
Fabulous book, Move Fast and Break Things. It's actually a quote from Mark Zuckerberg. What made you use that quote, and what was the context of it?
Well, I used it ironically, obviously, because I thought his notion that if you have to move fast and break things, you have to think about what you're breaking. And my thesis is that he's both breaking our culture and our democracy by moving so fast without thinking about what he's building.
When he made that remark, do you remember what the context was?
It was like a motto for his developers. In other words, he thought that you shouldn't worry about making software perfect. And obviously, part of this is this whole ethos of Silicon Valley that they're here to disrupt, and that disruption is the primary value of what they do. But you can go and disrupt the local news business with Facebook, which it's doing, and you're not replacing it with anything. So you basically kill the local newspaper business and you replace it with nothing. Well, who's going to go watch City Hall and make sure people aren't screwing the citizens? Or who's going to take care of watching over the police department, or, you know, those kinds of things that the local newspaper used to do? And obviously the same thing applies to the music business. You may have disrupted the music business and killed the revenue stream to music companies, dropping by 75% in the last 10 years. But what did you replace it with? You didn't. You're basically making it almost impossible for anybody but Jay-Z and Taylor Swift to make a living.
So let's back up then and talk about how you, in the introduction in particular, you said you thought you were going to write this thing about the so-called culture war and how Google and Amazon and Facebook had harmed artists and the arts itself. So this is what you were just saying, right? But what you found was that in this age of monopoly, it's really harming everything.
You know, we've always had, as a country, had to deal with monopoly. I mean, in the turn of, you know, the 20th century, clearly in 1906, Teddy Roosevelt felt that the dominance of Standard Oil over the energy business was too much. It had to be stopped. Or the way the railroads were monopolizing freight traffic and making it almost impossible for farmers to make a living. So we had to break up these monopolies. And so that's kind of been an American tradition. But somehow in the 1980s, the people in the Reagan administration convinced us that the only thing that mattered was price, consumer price. So ostensibly, if Amazon became the only retailer in America and put everybody else out of business, that would be fine as long as they could continue to crush prices by having so much power over producers the way they do with people who write books. So that, to me, is not a solution. And beyond that, you know, clearly if Facebook and Google and YouTube become this conduit for extraordinary amounts of propaganda and bad faith fake news, then that's not healthy for the society as well.
Right. And it seems to me that the monopolies we're dealing with today are actually more insidious than the ones historically because of the grasp on culture and because of the grasp on information. Would you think that would be the case?
Oh, certainly. Now, I used to think about the consolidation of the media business because I've made movies for many, many years, and the number of movie studios kept shrinking. But even at its worst, there were still seven studios, right? And they divvied up the business fairly evenly. But Google and Facebook last year took 88% of all new revenue in online advertising, 88% between two companies. So we've never had monopolies as powerful as that. And I don't think the average citizen understands that Google is a much larger media company in terms of revenue and advertising sales than Walt Disney, which is thought of as the largest company that owns ABC and ESPN and all those other TV stations. Walt Disney is dwarfed by Google.
You also noted that these companies have really caused, should I say, carefully, more inequality than any others.
Well, look, first, look at the Forbes 400 and the top 20 places on that list of the richest people in the world. About 17 of them are tech billionaires. With the exception of the Koch brothers, all the richest people in the world come out of tech. So that's one way it skews things. You know, the classic notion is when Mark Zuckerberg walks into a bar, the average earnings go up by 50%. That's the Republicans used to like to talk about median income. But it makes no sense when you're averaging in people who have net worth of 7, 10, 20 billion. That's one thing. But beyond that, it has two other effects. These people, and let's be clear that the tech companies do not hire a lot of people. So Facebook, which is the fourth largest firm in the world by market capitalization, only has 19,000 employees. I think the Ford Motor Company has something like 700,000 employees. These companies don't hire many people, but the people who are at the high end of the earnings scale are all millionaires. You know, people who are vice presidents are millionaires. So that skews income inequality. And the third way they skew income inequality, of course, is that by applying robotics, artificial intelligence, and all sorts of other things, they're basically putting lots of people out of work. And that's just going to get worse. I mean, if you think about Google is anxiously rolling out automated cars and trucks. And, you know, I heard an executive say at a tech conference in the spring that in the next 10 years, the long-haul trucking business would be completely automated. So that's 4 million people, 5 million people who are driving trucks today will be out of work. And when I asked him what he was going to do with those people, he said, that's not my problem. That's a political problem. But politicians aren't thinking about that. You know, Steve Mnuchin said the problem of unemployment caused by artificial intelligence and robotics was not going to happen for 100 years. So somebody at Google is saying going to happen in 10 years, and Steve Mnuchin says it's going to happen in 100 years. I'll bet on the guy from Google.
Is this what you call the economic war?
Well, it is an economic war in the sense that these three companies, Amazon, Google, and Facebook, will continue to dominate our economics for the next 10 to 20 years. They're in a virtuous circle right now. They have all the data on you and me and 2 billion other people. That data makes their artificial intelligence systems smarter, and that amount of money, because we all want to use their systems like Amazon Web Services, then they can hire the smartest data scientists. And so they keep getting better. So they're in a kind of virtuous circle, and their dominance will only increase. They're getting bigger. I mean, 10 years ago, the largest corporations in America were ExxonMobil, General Electric, and Citibank. And today, the largest corporations in America, in the world, are Apple, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and Facebook.
Let's turn to the democratic political aspect of this. And in particular, combined with this book that you wrote, you had sort of an excerpt that you wrote, I think it was in the Washington Monthly, that talked about the libertarian ethos and that all of these companies were essentially a product of this libertarian ethos that came from the Koch brothers. You quoted the Koch brothers as saying, we want to protect business from government. Talk to us about all these connections and how they fit together.
The libertarian theory, as framed by Ayn Rand and as repeated by David Koch and Peter Thiel, is that government is constantly impeding the brilliance of the tech entrepreneur or the forest product entrepreneur like David. In other words, as Peter Thiel put it, I don't believe that capitalism and democracy are compatible. He likes to see capitalism, but he thinks democracy gets in the way. And you know, in the Ayn Rand books, you always have this brave entrepreneur who's always constantly being hindered by the mob, by the demos, us, people, citizens. And so in their world, they want to construct a world in which there is no hindrance, no regulation, no way for government, politicians, citizens to regulate them. And, you know, for the tech billionaires, that's been the way they've lived for the last 20 years since Google came online. They've had no regulation. And that's why they're freaking out so much about this Russian propaganda thing and the very fact that for the first time, politicians have realized that this is kind of a Frankenstein monster and maybe it needs to be regulated. And of course, once you start regulating, you know, political advertising, well, then maybe you might look at some other things, you know, regulating how advertising companies are using your most intimate personal data to track you and follow you and, you know, sell you stuff you don't need. So at the end of the day, you have a situation where on one level, you've got these incredibly large corporations and incredibly rich people who want to do everything they can to keep politics from having any control over themselves. They don't want taxes. They don't want to spend any money on infrastructure. They just want to be left alone to earn their billions. That really requires democracy, us, to just become passive. And so, you know, as I put in that Washington Monthly piece, running an oligarchy, in other words, a society run just by the rich, is hard to do. And the only way to do it is either make it very hard to vote or distract people with stupid cat videos on YouTube to such a level that they don't even bother thinking about voting or politics or anything. And that's kind of the Aldous Huxley Brave New World theory of the future.
And you mentioned also having mechanisms to suppress voting as well as the propaganda to convince people that cultural divisions are more important than economic quality. These were all the things that you had written about in that piece that now you're referencing. And your point of that article was that these companies like Facebook and Google and, you know, potentially Amazon are needed by the 1%.
That's the vehicle that they use to put out their propaganda. I mean, it's not strange that the Mercer family, which are incredibly libertarian people who don't want any government and are, you know, trying to get out of paying $600 million in taxes that the federal government thinks they owe them. It's not weird that they would invest in Cambridge Analytica, a data firm, in order to create advertising for Donald Trump and for other reasons to confuse people as to what is really going on. That's part and parcel. So this is part of their playbook, and I think this is partially why they don't want anybody to regulate Google or Facebook.
You also mentioned that in this vision that the Charles Koch had when he built, say, for example, the Cato Institute, was ending things like public education, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the EPA. And we've been seeing, you know, very serious attempts to pull all of these things back. How does all that fit in, as you see it, into the Facebook, Google model? I mean, you would think that Facebook, Google, Amazon want educated people.
Well, the Trump administration is really the end point of a battle that the Koch brothers have been fighting since the late 70s, to have someone at the EPA like Scott Pruitt who would undo all of the environmental legislation of the last 30 years. It's what they've been hoping for. So Trump is a dream come true for them. And the same thing for Mercer. You know, and it's not just that stuff. It's not just environmental stuff. It's look at all the deregulation of Wall Street and all the other things that are being proposed. So, you know, Trump is a dream come true for these guys. I know that Mark Zuckerberg probably didn't intend to get Donald Trump elected, but even Donald Trump will tell you that he couldn't have gotten elected without Mark Zuckerberg. So it's a kind of naivete on the part of the tech companies. You know, when Sheryl Sandberg says, God, I was so shocked that people would use our ad tech to target anti-Semitic voters. Well, what the hell? You know, don't be so stupid. It's just completely naive.
You know, you mentioned quite a bit of how social media is really this unregulated Wild West. And so the material, the information that's coming out on it is obviously not checked by fact checkers, et cetera, and how this has been perfect for somebody like Donald Trump, who can tweet whatever he wants, doesn't have to go through, you know, any kind of a news editor. But you didn't target Twitter in the book?
Twitter is a kind of plaything of a bunch of journalists and a few elite people in Washington. Its influence in the greater scheme of things, I don't think is that large, quite honestly. I mean, I think the total number of users of Twitter in the world is in the hundreds of millions. So Facebook has 2 billion users. I know we all go on Twitter and it seems like it's important, but in the greater scheme of things, in terms of trying to get Trump elected, Twitter was not important.
Let's turn also to culture and the arts. And you come out of that world. You've done both music and movies. And it seemed to me that the birth of this book came from your experience with the band, right? And
yep.
There was that interaction that you had with one of the Reddit founders, which was fascinating, frankly, that he so didn't quite get it. But let's talk about the effect on art and artists, but perhaps within the context of why art is important and why artists are important in the first place.
I'm a kind of Thoreau modeler. I think that the notion that artists in America and obviously in other places have always been the kind of people who saw earlier what the problems were and called them out, and then the politicians came along. So if you really look at the history of America, you know, Emerson and Thoreau in the early 1830s were railing against slavery and against American imperialism, the Mexican War, and it took till the late 1850s or early 1860s for the politicians to catch up. So you look at Mark Twain writing a book called The Gilded Age in the 1880s. So he prefigured what Teddy Roosevelt would actually do in terms of saying, look, these monopolists have too much power. And obviously I would cite my own history of thinking in the very early 1960s, what the music business, what the folk musicians like Bob Dylan and Joan Baez and the Chambers brothers were doing in the civil rights movement before Lyndon Johnson was even conscious of it. So I think the role the artist plays, as Thoreau said, is to throw some sand in the gears of the machine. And that's been true all over the world for many, many societies. And if we make art into just entertainment and everything is like a Marvel comic book, then obviously it may be very helpful to politicians who want to put people to sleep, but it's not helpful to wake people up, which is what artists have supposedly been meant to do. They're supposed to think about what society could be. You know, that's why you write a song like Blowing in the Wind or The Times They Are Changing. You want to imagine a world that could be better than it is, and that's really the role that the artist plays.
And so now they're facing this technology that is making it hard to make a living. Tell us.
Well, it's apocalyptic. It's apocalyptic. I mean, you think about it. The revenues for music business have fallen by 75%. Revenues for newspapers have fallen by almost 80%. Revenues for book publishing have been crushed. Now the movie business is getting hit. So what happens is, it's not like people stop listening to music or reading newspapers or watching movies or reading books. It's just that the revenue got reallocated from the people who actually made the content to the people who controlled the portal through which you got access to the content, whether that was Google or Facebook or Amazon. And, you know, you can look at the revenue curves falling for all the content companies, and you look at the revenue curves rising for all these ad-supported and e-commerce monopolies, and you can see just so clearly what's going on. And it's rotten.
And so in terms of new artists who have something to say, they can still use these platforms, but they can't make a living.
No, I mean, my son is a recording engineer in Oakland. Nobody among the kids that he hangs out with ever thinks they'll make a living off the recordings. So they have to make a living the way musicians made a living in the 16th century. Rent a room, lock the doors, make people to pay to get in the room with you. So here we are in the digital age with 5 billion smartphones in the world, and a musician has to make a living the way he made a living in the 16th century. It's insane.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Jonathan Taplin about his new book, Move Fast and Break Things.
Let's turn to some of the other people that you talk about in the book. One is Peter Thiel. For people who don't know who Peter Thiel is, give us a little background and tell us what his role is in all this.
So Peter Thiel came out of Stanford in the late 80s. He edited the Stanford Review, which was a right-wing libertarian paper. He made a speech at the Cato Institute saying that the biggest mistake America made was to give women the right to vote because women are too soft and want to do, support welfare and stuff like that. While he was at Stanford, he railed against the homosexual culture and what he called the culture of kind of identitarian culture on college campuses. And then he went on to found PayPal. I mean, the ironic thing was, of course, while he was railing against this culture of permissiveness, he was a closeted gay man, which is his right to be whatever he wants. But once that was revealed, of course, by Gawker magazine, he spent 8 years making sure that he could destroy Gawker magazine. Despite his belief in the First Amendment, there's no First Amendment when it comes to his life. He founded a company called PayPal, which was essentially a hack on the payment system. And then he became the initial investor in Facebook. So he also owns a company called Palantir, which is probably the greatest surveillance corporation in the world. Was initially funded by the CIA and does work for governments all over the world to spy on people. He's as libertarian as you can possibly be, and he has an extraordinary effect. He's very close to the Trump administration. He was one of the earliest endorsers of Trump from the business world. He spoke at the Republican convention, and he's very close to Jared Kushner. So I think Peter Thiel is a destructive force in our society. He's the one who believed that the net should operate without any taxes. So, you know, Jeff Bezos could sell books without paying taxes and put 4,000 independent bookstores out of business. He believed that copyright was not an important thing, so YouTube can operate in a way that no musician has any right to get their content off of YouTube permanently. And finally, he classically said that competition is for losers, meaning that monopoly is really the only way to make money in this current age.
And then what about Kim.com? Tell us about Kim.com.
So Kim.com is a German felon who was convicted of hacking into major American corporations' mainframes in the 80s. So he went to jail for that for a while in Germany. And then he got out, and then he made a bunch of money as a consultant to companies who wanted to prevent people from hacking into their computers. And then he spent that money on a pump-and-dump scheme with a German e-commerce company where he bought 10% of the stock and said he was going to invest millions. The stock shot up 40%, and Kim.com sold all his stock and went off to Bangkok, and this company crashed. And so he was convicted on that one, securities fraud, brought back to Germany. When he got out of jail the second time, he went to Hong Kong and then New Zealand and set up a service called Mega Upload, which was a pirate site for music and movies funded by advertising. And at one time, it was, I think, about 2% of all the world's net traffic was flowing through Mega Upload. He made himself $400 or $500 million. Not a single musician or filmmaker whose content was on his system ever got paid a penny. And Kim.com made off all of the money, had large yachts and private jets and a huge mansion in New Zealand. And
where Peter,
eventually,
where Peter Thiel, by the way, just bought citizenship.
Yeah, yeah. So eventually he got busted, but now he's fighting extradition. You know, we would like him brought back to the United States, and New Zealand is allowing him to fight it.
Three other things I'd like to touch on if we can get through them. One is we all have a role in turning over our information to Google, and you sort of juxtaposed, you know, Edward Snowden exposing the NSA spying, and there was so much outrage. But we are all turning far more information over to Google, but there's no outrage.
Right.
How can we deal with this? How do you see this?
Well, I think the average citizen doesn't really understand what they have turned over to Google. I was at a tech conference over the weekend, and a brilliant engineer said, well, the smartphone is one of those half-silvered mirrors where, you know, from one side, it looks like from a mirror. On the other side, someone can look at you looking at yourself in the mirror. And what you don't understand is what the people on the other side of the mirror have got on you. And if you really knew how much data they had on you, you would probably be a little frightened. And so the question then becomes, are people going to become aware of what that's all about? So I cite an example in China. There's a service called Sesame Social Credit, which is run by Alibaba. And what that does is it overlays your credit score with your social media habits which are all kind of culled from every available source and kind of worked through an artificial intelligence algorithm to score you. So if, for instance, you spent 5 hours yesterday playing video games, your social credit score would go down because you're considered a slacker. If you wrote something on WeChat that was critical of the Chinese government, your social credit score would go down because you were considered unpatriotic. If you jaywalked in Shanghai on one of those ubiquitous security cameras with facial recognition caught you, your social credit score would go down. So you would think, who would want to get on that? Well, there's 200 million people who've signed up for this service, and the evidence is that the millennials are using their Sesame social credit score on their dating apps to prove that they're good, upstanding, patriotic citizens worthy of marriage, which to me is really kind of scary. I mean, it's really the ultimate Orwellian nightmare of social control. The Chinese president, 2 weeks ago, he said that he thought every citizen should be on Sesame social credit. So that's kind of the end state of where you would go with the kind of information that Google or Facebook, they could roll out a service like that in 2 seconds. So that's my big worry in the near term, and whether people will begin to realize that, you know, Facebook is not necessarily your friend is an open question.
And now while we're dealing with the hearings about the Russian hacking and also the proliferation of the fake news items, plus Steve Bannon using the bot systems, which you'll have to help us understand, to proliferate this even more, that's also coming full circle to where we started, which is in the democratic realm. Walk us through this.
Essentially, what happens is, let's say I want to suppress voting in Milwaukee, Philadelphia, and Chicago among young African Americans. So I write a meme, which is a picture of Hillary Clinton standing outside a jail cell with a young black man behind bars. And it says, Hillary Clinton says that all young black men are super predators. And then I put that out on Facebook and I target just young African Americans in these cities. And then I hit it also with bots so that it pushes it higher on the news feeds of all the targeted people that I want. And I have a self-fulfilling prophecy. And obviously I can do that with positive things too. I can say Donald Trump is endorsed by the Pope, which was another one of these memes. And so then I hit that with bots. And I force it to the top of the Google, you know, search algorithm, and I push it to the top of the Facebook trending topics algorithm. That's why Facebook had to disclose that these fake things were viewed by probably as many as 150 million people. Because it wasn't that they actually targeted 150 million people. It was just the combination of using organic posts plus bots to amplify them created a virality of it that made it go everywhere.
So given now that we have Donald Trump as the president, the Republicans controlling the Congress and a lot of the courts, certainly the Supreme Court, and not and these sort of libertarian-minded Republicans like you're describing, where do you see this going? I mean, without policy and law, there's not much that we will see as a remedy, do you think?
There's two ways of thinking about this, one of which is that maybe, you know, people like Al Franken and his speech to the Open Markets Institute or, you know, Elizabeth Warren, maybe the combination of politicians on the left who are very strong on these issues and bizarrely politicians on the right like Steve Bannon, Tucker Carlson, Bill Kristol, who think these companies have gotten too big and need to be regulated from a kind of populist point of view, maybe it's a perfect storm and maybe something will happen. Certainly, if you looked at 3 weeks ago, Google was fighting like crazy to stop a bill from going through Congress, which would have penalized Google if it linked to child sex trafficking sites. And Google was really fighting it. And eventually, even Google realized that that was just like a bridge too far for most politicians. And even all the political power they had, they couldn't get that through. And so last week, they gave up on that. So that tells me that if someone's willing to modify the safe harbor laws to make an exception for childhood sex trafficking, why wouldn't we modify the safe harbor laws to make an exception for the 40,000 ISIS beheading videos that are on YouTube? And so maybe something's beginning to change, and that would be remarkable.
One of the other things we didn't touch on, but you noted it in the book, and I thought it was important enough that we should talk about it, has to do with the role of addiction on these things.
Yeah.
What do you make of this? Is this playing on our addictions? Are we addicted to this, you know, incoming, constant, you know, fake news, email? How are these related?
Well, what's astonishing is that Sean Parker, who was one of the founders of Facebook, gave an interview this morning in which he said, yeah, we built addiction into these systems. That was the whole idea. And he said, I have no idea what it's doing to brains of children. So, I mean, here was one of the founders of Facebook admitting that the whole idea was to addict people to their system. I noted a startup called Dopamine Labs that just has been publicizing itself, which just advertises its ability to addict you, you know, dopamine. It's so perfect, the name, to any app and figure out triggers for that. You know, there's a book called Hooked, which is, you know, how to build addictive applications. So I think it's probably one of the most dangerous parts of the whole thing. I mean, there's a wonderful young man named Tristan Harris who's going around the country talking about it. He was an engineer at Google, and he saw firsthand what they were trying to do to keep people addicted to the app. And he decided to speak out. He's like a whistleblower. So it's interesting to see, you know, the people who were involved in this from the beginning begin to realize that, oh my God, we may have created something that's not that good for people.
So now let's talk about possible solutions. You talked about a few in the book. You talked about co-ops as a possibility, as an example. That's something that I've written about as well. Why don't we outline some of these possible ways of solving these problems?
The first thing is to think about a few legislative fixes that could be done fairly quickly. The situation that Al Franken mentioned, which is to apply the kind of net neutrality laws to Google so that Google couldn't favor its own content over the content of third parties, that would be a good solution. The second one would be to have some kind of law, which I call take down, stay down, which means that if I, as a musician, told YouTube to take down my song off of their platform, then YouTube would have the responsibility to do it instead of the way that exists now, which is I file a takedown notice, 3 or 4 days later, the song goes down, and then the next day it goes right back up from another user. So I'm playing a game of whack-a-mole. I mean, 1 billion takedown notices filed last year. It's a joke. So that would be helpful. The third would be some kind of privacy legislation. And I know that's kind of stalled right now, but Marsha Blackburn has been pushing it. The European Union is going to put its GDPR, which is General Data Privacy Regulation, through. That takes effect in May of 2018. That will have a profound effect on these companies. And then the final remedy may be that we have to break these companies up. It may be that Google has to sell YouTube and has to sell DoubleClick, and Facebook has to sell Instagram and WhatsApp, and Amazon has to sell Whole Foods or, you know, Zappos or one of the thousands of companies it's bought.
One of the things I wonder, given particularly in the United States and places like the United States where you've got state laws as well that could take on some of these issues?
A brave attorney general like Maura Healey in Massachusetts could create an antitrust suit. Look at what happened to Snapchat in the past 6 months. So Facebook went to Snapchat and said, we want to buy you for $3 billion. Snapchat had the gall to turn them down. And so what did Facebook do? They went back and basically ripped off everything that Snapchat does. And literally the week before Snapchat goes public, comes into the market with an exact clone. They didn't even change the name. So it was Snapchat Stories. Now it's Instagram Stories, Facebook Stories, WhatsApp Stories. And they just killed Snapchat. It went out public at $28 a share, and I think it's at $12 a share today. And they didn't just kill them on the stock market. They killed them with advertisers. They basically told every advertiser, why would you possibly want to advertise on Snapchat Stories when we can give you 50 times the reach on Facebook with the exact same application?
So can a company come up as the alternative Facebook at this point, or is it just...
No. There's no chance. Any company that gets a little bit big, all they want is to sell themselves to Google or Facebook or Amazon. There's no ambition to be the new Facebook. It's the ambition is to be bought by Facebook.
I noticed in your book you talked about initially Facebook, Google, all of these companies had gone into that organization, ALEC, that the Koch brothers had, you know, put together to try to push forward these ideologies and push through policies that supported that ideology. But some of them have pulled out since then, right?
Yeah, but they don't have any ideology. You know, Eric Schmidt, oh, I'm a big Hillary Clinton supporter. She loses. 2 weeks later, he shows up at the White House or at Trump Tower for a meeting and does an epic suck up to Donald Trump. They don't have any ideology. Their ideology is to make money. So the notion that don't be evil or that these are some kind of, you know, social benefit organizations is a joke.
And so when you're dealing with these, this is, you know, the Koch brothers ideology, and like you noted in your Washington Monthly article about George Stigler suggesting that we needed to restrict voting to property owners and educated classes. I mean, do they even get a grasp of that type of thinking among the Cato, Koch brothers, Stigler mindset?
Well, look, I mean, some of them do, some of them don't. I went out of my way to kind of give Mark Zuckerberg some room, you know, to prove himself. I mean, clearly Peter Thiel totally believes in everything David Koch believes in. And probably Larry Page does too. He seems to be a fairly strong libertarian. Certainly Jeff Bezos has been a strong libertarian. Whether Mark Zuckerberg does or not is still an open question, but he's a young man, so we'll see.
Well, let me thank you for your time here, Jonathan Taplin. Move Fast and Break Things is the name of the book. Really appreciate your research and really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Taplin was the founding director of the USC Annenberg Innovation Lab. He is an Oscar-nominated filmmaker, a music manager, and author. His latest book is called Move Fast and Break Things: How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Have Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. When we come back, how one university professor is teaching children about community, civics, empathy, and giving. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guest has integrated a program into her university teaching. The Penny Harvest works with both university students and school children at the LA Unified School District and other schools to teach children leadership skills, empathy, community service, and about philanthropy. Ann Kriegler joins us now. She's a professor of political science at the University of Southern California and co-author of the books
news and the construction of political meaning, crosstalk, and the affect effect, dynamics of emotion in political thinking and behavior.
How did you find out about a program like this to begin with?
My brother-in-law was on the board of the Penny Harvest group in New York, and I found out about what he was doing, and I thought that was such a great idea. I'd really like to bring it to Los Angeles.
And what was he doing?
He himself was helping them to do financial matters and to try to spread the Penny Harvest program in the schools. And I was really interested in the fact that they were really trying to get children to get civically engaged, no matter what their economic and political backgrounds. And instead of using just a kind of a boring civic education, they used philanthropy as the tool. And they said, okay, let's go out and think about your community. What are the issues that are really important in your community to you and your friends? And how might you be able to help them? By raising some pennies, and everyone can participate. And then you can figure out how you want to donate those pennies. The children were doing great. In fact, the children in New York, it was one of the most popular philanthropies in the city. And Mayor Bloomberg named it one of his favorite philanthropies. And they raised millions of dollars over years.
From pennies?
From pennies.
What did they end up donating to in New York?
All kinds of things. They're really basically focusing on areas of need for problems that the children see. So it's incredibly important that the children are the ones who define the issues, not the adults. And children notice all kinds of things. So they would notice about homelessness, they would notice about poverty of various sorts, illness, animals, they wanted to help animals. They were interested in children around the world.
How old were the children in New York that did the Penny Harvest? And how old are the children that you work with here?
The children in New York were originally in any school, K through 12. The program decided that the older kids really didn't have enough going in the agenda and the program, so they cut it back to elementary school students. And we've only been working with elementary school students here in LA.
So you found out about the program in New York, and you thought, maybe I can do this at USC and integrate it into my teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Walk us through the steps of how this developed here and what it has developed into.
I was basically on sabbatical, and I thought I need a new project. And I talked to the founder of the Penny Harvest program, Teddy Gross, and he was kind of interested in the idea that it would be a very different economic model and a different model of spreading the Penny Harvest from the one he had used, because he set up a nonprofit and did very little hands-on in the schools, but spread it to many, many schools. And I said, what I'd like to do would be more hands-on in the schools with my students to do some kind of cascading learning between college students and elementary school kids, and then have the foundation of it be the university. So they wouldn't have to pay for me to be the director of some nonprofit. I would be teaching my class and use that as the way to kind of leverage the resources of the university to help the community.
So then you had a class, and it was called what?
The first class is called Civic Engagement and Leadership, and there's a second class in the spring semester that's working on representation and advocacy of issues.
And these are university students,
mm-hmm.
and the class is designed around them working with elementary school students in civic engagement.
Yes. So it just uses philanthropy to help the children understand how resources are used to help other people, and how you really can make a difference even just with one penny when you work together to gather your pennies together and help other people in the community. And what's really amazing is that the schools here have been super helpful, and the coaches run the program in the schools, and my students come in and help the coaches.
Coaches in athletics?
No, the coaches are teachers in the elementary schools. Sometimes a librarian, sometimes a vice principal, but often teachers.
What have the children done in Los Angeles? And you said they're elementary school, so they're what age group?
The whole school participates in the gathering of the pennies, and that takes place usually between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And That involves kids as young as pre-kindergarten all the way up to the sixth grade. And we worked originally in some private schools that went up to eighth grade, so we had up to eighth grade students. And then there's a leadership roundtable that actually works to make the decisions. And those are usually about 20 students in each school that work together over the course of the year to run the whole program along with the coach. And it's amazing because you see kids in age 3 to 5 usually take on these leadership roles. And they go into the other classrooms and they teach the children how about the community, what issues they want to examine, what are they interested in. And they talked about what community issues are and why you want to care. And then they go and find out what are the issues really that the children want to know about and how can they represent them. And then they do a poll sometimes, or they do other ways of finding out how they're going to narrow down the wheel of caring, which is a large set of issues that each classroom comes up with in the school. So you have however many classrooms in the school, you have a piece of pie essentially that names an issue that those children are interested in. So it might be helping kids with cancer, it might be giving to the animal shelter, it might be helping the homeless, it might be cleaning up the parks. They've done all those things. And then the children figure out what issues are most important. They decide on one or two issues that they're going to focus on. And then they do research on community organizations here in Los Angeles that work to help on those problems. Mm-hmm. And that's an amazing enterprise too, because these children learn how to interview adults who are running the nonprofits, and they grill them. And how do you spend the money? What are you going to do with our money? And why is it worth giving our money to you as opposed to some other organization? And the organizations have been terrific. And they love the idea that these children are giving gifts to start to help join the community, to become involved, to get engaged. And so they've done a lot with the children. So for example, 1 year White Memorial Hospital received a gift from one of the schools, and the school children said that they were really wanting to help kids with cancer. Mm. So the hospital said, that is so wonderful. We're going to put a bell in our garden so that when every child finishes their treatment, they can go out and ring the bell, and they'll know that the children from this neighborhood help them to have this wonderful experience. And so they also, the hospital invited the children over to the hospital and showed them where their money was being used and what the procedures were the children had to go through when they had mm-hmm. cancer. So the children got this whole additional kind of connection with the community mm-hmm. and learned about science, and we're also able to see where the scary things happen when children get sick. So it was amazing. It was really amazing.
And it's making them more civic-minded, mm-hmm. having them think about things in more of a big picture. They're out gathering these pennies from just family, friends. Where are they gathering the pennies from?
Well, that's usually from family and friends. It's a little scary sometimes to go into the neighbor and talk to people you don't know. So it's usually from family or friends. They might find pennies in the street. Sometimes kids have saved up pennies themselves and they'll give them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the parents help them. We had one child who was amazing, and he was very dedicated to this effort. And he told his mother every night, you sign me up, you agree to do this, so we're going out and we're gonna raise pennies. And that child by himself raised $140 wow. in pennies.
How old was he?
He was in the fourth grade.
Wow. They would have to be children that have some resources.
No.
Not very poor children who can't afford pencils, for example,
no.
for their own schools.
Yeah, one would think that would be true, but you wouldn't understand what's really going on here, because the schools we're working with, probably 90% of the children are on free lunch. So these are not wealthy children. These are not wealthy families, but they are very generous and they are very giving. And each child can participate because it's not the amount of money. That's not the point. The point is that you are participating and learning about the community, learning how to care for others. One of the things the teachers and the principals notice most is how much the empathy of the children has increased, because they're no longer just thinking about themselves, but they're thinking about the wider community and how they can help and be part of that wider community.
And problem solving.
Right. Right. Take leadership. I mean, when you see a third grader go into a fifth grade class to explain to them how to go about doing the penny harvest, it's impressive.
And what about the university students? How many of those do you have, and how are they engaged in this?
They're small classes because it's a research intensive class, and it also involves a great deal of field work. So I purposely keep the seminar very small. And they go each week into the schools to work with the children. They also plan a leadership academy where the students from each of the elementary schools come to USC once a semester and are trained for the day in different leadership skills. So the students in my class figure out what are the skills they want to train them in and help them with, and what do they need to know, and how are they going to get there. And then it's amazing to see how the students don't know any of the other children from the other schools, and they get to know each other, and they start talking across the school differences, and they start to form some real friendships, and at least acquaintanceships, and feel comfortable, both with the other children from the other schools and also the USC students.
So it's building community.
Totally building community, building a lot of social skills, a lot of confidence, great deal of public speaking and persuasion skills. So those are all things that are kind of soft skills that are important to their success later.
Well, Ann Kriegler, thank you so much for being with us on the Scholar Circle.
It's a pleasure, Maria.
Ann Kriegler is a professor of political science at the University of Southern California and co-author of the books Common Knowledge, Crosstalk, and The Affect Effect, Dynamics of Emotion in Political Thinking and Behavior.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.